And welcome to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, host for this wonderful program right here on Progressive Radio Network. And just a few announcements that we're gathering our energy for our trip to Jamaica coming up in March 15th to 20th. So if people want more information and perhaps want to travel and meet some Jamaican bush doctors and study the herbs and folklore of Jamaica, you can get more information on naturalnurse.com, which is Dr. Kamai's website. Also, we have our other events posted on that website, so you can get more information with that. So, well, today's program is going to be on holistic pain relief, and as you know, that's something that first and foremost is most interesting to myself and Dr. Kamai, who have written very comprehensive books on the management of arthritis and autoimmune disease and other types of pain management systems. And we're really excited to have on Dr. Heather Tick, who is an integrated medical practitioner out in Seattle, Washington, associated with UW, University of Washington. And she is a professor for integrated pain management out there. And she wrote a book, really interesting, Holistic Pain Relief, Breakthrough Strategies to Manage and Eliminate Pain. We're really excited to have her on for those patients who have pain and suffer with this chronic pain, which is an epidemic in New York and in North America. I find that certainly on the East Coast here, that's where I've been practicing for 25 years. There's a lot of people in pain. I'm sure you see that all over the country, right, Dr. Tick?
Absolutely. It seems to be epidemic, very much so in the U.S. It is a worldwide problem, certainly, but we seem to have taken a particularly troublesome approach to how we treat it, and it hasn't worked very well.
It's so interesting that many cultures have many names for pain. Like, for instance, you know, I practice Chinese medicine, and there's all kinds of different pains that over the thousands of years of that system, they've discussed, you know, damp pain, wet pain, heat pain, draft pain, wind pain. So it's very interesting how they've tied it together with the external environment, and not all one pain fits all, but from kind of like from a biomedical perspective, how did pain become such an important topic in your professional development?
Well, what I found when I started out my practice many years ago as a family physician, that the problems that I had the most difficult time helping people get to a resolution about, you don't. There's very few things in medicine that we actually fix or cure. But you want to get people into a place where they're managing and they're comfortable. And the chronic pain patients were the most difficult ones to solve. And as a young physician, I was referring widely to colleagues to try and develop my own skills, develop my own understandings of how to help people. And there wasn't really much in the community either where I was looking. And in those days, I was looking a little bit at the alternatives, certainly more at the conventional, and I wasn't finding answers.
Yeah, and, you know, they look at pain. Well, let's talk about pain a little bit. The statistics are staggering, and you start your book by talking about just fascinating statistics about how many people suffer from pain and how it robs people of good parts of their life, and why, if it's such a big problem, is it not being managed properly? So those are all things maybe you can touch based on.
Sure. Well, 100 million people in chronic pain in this country, and that's not counting everybody because it leaves out children, it leaves out people in prisons, it leaves out people in assisted living and senior citizens in care. So the numbers are truly much bigger than that, and that's only chronic pain, not acute pain, so not something that happens in the short term. And that is estimated to cost us at least $600 billion And it, again, it leaves out the numbers that would apply to those other people that I just mentioned that get left out of these statistics. So we're, you know, logistically speaking, we're probably really talking about close to $1 trillion a year on pain that we spend without getting much benefit for people from it. And we have a pill culture in this country where we think and we've conditioned our population and our medical personnel to think that every solution has a pill. There's a perfect pill. We look at people with a very complex situation that I talk a little bit about in the book, using it as analogies in terms of heart disease. What is the complex set of circumstances that causes that? And we've boiled it down to one thing, which is cholesterol, and we've boiled that down to one solution, which is a pill. And the fact is that that doesn't work. We have more people with heart disease now and more people dying of heart disease now than before we started with this class of drug called statins. And then when we look at pain pills, it gets even worse. So we have acetaminophen, which is on the market, which is effective, but it has such a narrow effective range that you can very easily get into the area of toxicity, which can be very serious in terms of liver and kidneys. It's a very common cause of overdose in emergency rooms. And then the next class of drugs are the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. And most physicians don't know, let alone people out there on the street, that these drugs that they can buy over the counter cause at least 16,500 deaths a year in the U.S. That's more than AIDS and cervical cancer put together. And that's only counting the people who take non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, which are drugs like ibuprofen. It's only counting the people who take those drugs for osteoarthritis and rheumatoid arthritis. It's not counting back pain, neck pain, headache, menstrual cramps.
And then the opioids, they're a big problem too.
The opioids are the biggest problem. And those, North America, the U.S. consumes 50 times more opioid than the rest of the world put together.
Wow.
Tell me how that makes any sense.
Well, you could see vicious and inhumane crimes committed by people hooked on these medications. And, you know, the opioids have been used for a really long time, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Emperor Shen Nong talked about them in 2737 B.C. But they've become so addictive, and they've always had problems, and there's so many natural solutions for these types of things. But before we get into that, let's actually just talk about pain. And what I loved about your book is how you actually not only talked about pain, but gave a couple of great case studies where you were working with people and how you're more patient-focused versus problem-focused. I think you used that actual phrase in your book there, which I really love, being a naturopathic doctor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually training really close to UW at Bastyr many moons ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I studied many nights at UW Library, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But
we have a good connection at UW with Bastyr.
Yes, yes. But, you know, the way I look at it is pain can be managed. We can inhibit the initiation of the pain message. We can control inflammation, we could change the magnitude of the pain message or completely block it, i.e., you know, you gave some examples of that in the book, and anesthesia would be a good example of that. But then we can also limit the perception of pain and control the patient's reaction to pain, give them a different explanation of why they're having this or some hope. So tell us a little bit about how you think of pain and think of not only a biomedical example, but also kind of like a mind-body-spirit example.
Sure. I think you've laid out the turf extremely well there. We have, because we've got this idea that we need to have fixes for things, and we need to have instant fixes, which usually come in the form of pills, and all you have to do is turn on the TV or look at any magazine to see this, just blatant, outrageous advertising of drugs to the public. You'll see that we've trained people to think there has to be something instant, and if there isn't instant relief, that there's a problem, and there's a lot of fear and anxiety that goes with that, rather than recognizing that there's certain natural laws. If you eat right, you change your body chemistry in a positive way, and you decrease inflammation. If you eat donuts and soda pop for breakfast, you're going to increase your inflammation. You're going to increase the amount of food you want to eat. You're going to make it much more likely that you're going to eat junk food through the day, and you're going to continue to increase your inflammation. You're going to feel crummy. You're not going to be able to think straight. You're going to be more anxious every time you spike your blood sugar from the junk food. And this is going to put you in a terrible cycle that is deteriorating, as opposed to simply turning it around by eating properly, lots of fruits and vegetables, lots of whole natural foods, decreasing your body-wide inflammation, improving the level at which your brain can function, and decreasing your anxiety, and then you start to heal your body. Our bodies have the capacity to heal forever. When I went to medical school, you probably had a very different experience in naturopathy school. I was never taught about healing. Healing only had to do with you make an incision, or somebody cuts themselves, or somebody has a broken bone. In that regard, we talk about healing. But there are things that are healing and changing and remodeling in our bodies constantly. We make a billion new cells a day. And there's a lot going on. And if people just recognize that, if they can provide the right raw materials, their body can make healthier cells. Their body can make neurotransmitters that are calming. So that kind of an education to people, which is what I do in my office, helps them to recognize that they do have some control, and control is really important. One of the things I talk about in the book is that, if you're in charge of your pain, if you take, part of your skin or your muscle and you pinch it really, 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 really hard, there's no fear with that. There's no, it's not unmanageable pain, because you can stop it at any time. Mm. When there's a lack of understanding of what are all the things that lead to our pain and what are all the things that we can do to self-soothe, then things have a different emotional reaction for us, and that's where the mind-body comes in. So teaching people ways to balance their sympathetic nervous system, which is the fight or flight side, the stress side, or the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the de-stress side. And when those two things are well balanced, we decrease the inflammation in our body, and a lot of good things happen. But many of us lead lives that are very stressful, and when we don't focus on health, it leads to more stress. And we don't have an understanding, it leads to more stress. And the stress response, as you well know, causes your heart rate to go up, your blood sugar goes up, you mobilize essential fatty acids, your brain focuses in very, very sharply and doesn't really pay attention to all the things in your environment, because the stress response is actually designed to help us run away from the saber-toothed tiger. And if you're running away from the tiger and you see something interesting on the side of the road, you're dead meat. So you better focus on just running away. And so that's the way parts of our brain shut down. And our digestion shuts down, and our reproductive functions and hormones shut down because you don't need them. And our immune system shuts down. And if it's just a run from the tiger and then we manage to get away, our body recovers very quickly and gets back to normal. But if we have those stress responses a dozen times before we get to the bus stop in the morning because of all the little aggravations and how stressed and pressured our lives are, then our digestion remains a problem because we're constantly interfering with it. Our hormones become an issue. Our mental focus becomes an issue, and we stop taking all of the context into account when we're thinking, and our immune system suffers too.
Yeah, beautiful, well said.
And I guess in the beginning when you're working with patients, I know I always start with a really long intake form. People yell at me like, what is this? So I usually send them the intake form ahead of time so they can give thought. You know, if you're in the office and it's busy and they only have like 10 minutes to fill out this intake form, it's not going to work. My intake form really is a self-assessment form, a personal health assessment, kind of like you mentioned in your book here on the chapter of Visit with an Integrative Physician. And you ask great questions, too, like diet. And we'll talk more about that. I want to get into that because you seem to be very focused on diet, which is awesome. Also, exercise. What types of exercise? We believe that, you know, in naturopathic medicine, that one exercise doesn't fit all. Some people thrive doing martial arts. I'm a black belt in Tang Soo Do, and for my body type, I need that explosive. I'm like a hunter-gatherer type. I need that type of stuff to de-stress. Whereas other people, yoga and other types of things would be the more appropriate exercise for them. So one, just like one diet doesn't fit all, one exercise doesn't fit all. And then you talk about breathing, which is, we want to talk about your portable stress reduction free, and I emphasize free, stress management system. And then sleep. And then your home environment, like to use chemicals and pesticides and things like that. And then work. And then a lot of information about stress. And then the spiritual side of things. So I think it's a very important intake is to know a lot about your patient. And I've never seen intakes like this in most conventional doctors' offices.
And that's very true. And I'm sure what you find after your patients take their intake, which is probably similar to what my patients experience, is that in itself is an educational experience. They learn something just from filling out the form because they suddenly feel that, oh, my God, these things are important.
Yeah.
And they never realized it before.
Very true.
Yeah.
Let's talk about diet and its association with pain. Now, this is kind of medical heresy in a way because, you know, we're still living in a paradigm where doctors don't even still pay attention to diet for the most part. So I've seen, and you said that, and you start off the chapter, before societies existed, we humans occupied most of our time with food. It was like a huge, huge deal, and it's a huge deal with Thanksgiving coming up and the holidays. You know, a lot of our major rituals involve food, and including our daily rituals too, not just our kind of coming together and enjoying wonderful things with our family and friends, but every day is every moment we have a choice of whether to choose a path of pain or a path of non-pain with our food. Go into your what you talked about in your book about food and how it impacts pain.
Sure. I think that we change our body chemistry every time we eat, and we either increase inflammation when we eat high glycemic foods that spike our sugar quickly, so things with refined flour, refined sugars, and when we eat the wrong fats, or we decrease our inflammation when we eat good, healthy oils like nuts, seed, olive oils, avocado, whole grains, lots of fresh vegetables and fruit, and healthy meats that are humanely raised so that the animals aren't super stressed and aren't artificially fattened. I think those foods are what we are genetically programmed to eat from the beginnings of when we started to be. Our genetics haven't changed very much. But our food, when you look at how our diet has changed, especially in North America, it's so processed. When you go into an average supermarket, there are close to 50,000 different items on the shelf. Now, that doesn't mean that you know, 20,000 of them are one type of mushroom soup. It's different items. And if you put a primitive person in there, if you put one of our great-grandparents in there, they would not recognize most of those things as food. And most of them, I don't think, are food. I think all the goodness has been processed out of them. I think there's very little nutritional value. Adding back a little bit of unbalanced nutritional value to a food that has been stripped of all its natural wonderfulness is a silly idea. I don't know who thinks this is a good idea.
Yeah.
And one of the really interesting things that I found out while I was researching for this book is that if you look at the purpose of the development of the USDA, so a lot of us get our information from the USDA, thinking that is objective nutritional information. But when you look at what their goals are, it's to promote food businesses.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with health of the nation.
Exactly.
That's not part of their mandate.
To sell food, and the big agri-food giants are certainly wanting to spike food to make it more addictive so you buy more of it. So I think that they spend a lot of time figuring out how people can eat more of these types of foods and how they can be addicted to these things. I mean, they've actually proven that there's addictive qualities to, especially the newfangled genetically modified wheats and dairy and things like that. I mean, they've actually shown, I know in my class, I teach at the University of Bridgeport in the College of Naturopathic Medicine, and you know, I've actually found literature on gliadomorphins, which are kind of morphine-like compounds that your body makes when you eat a piece of bread or pasta or something with the kind of the newer gluten, and that's not even including the fact that most of it doesn't have any fiber, and you mentioned it spikes your blood sugar. How does spiking blood sugar create inflammation and pain for the listeners?
Well, when you spike your blood sugar, there's a release of cytokines in response. Well, first thing you do is you increase your insulin to try and clear the blood sugar out of the blood. And it's insulin that actually is the culprit in terms of stimulating this cascade of pro-inflammatory cytokines, these chemicals that are designed for a purpose in our body. I mean, inflammation isn't all bad. Inflammation is also the first step in all of healing. So we wouldn't heal if we didn't have an inflammatory step where the tissues release inflammatory markers and then the immune system comes in and starts to heal it up. It's when it goes wild and is excessive that it causes the formation of more free radicals. So free radicals are these highly active, reactive molecules that are looking for electrons, and they go around trying to steal them from our organs, from our tissues, from our cells. And so they'll steal them from different molecules in our cells, which then damages the cells. And then that causes more of an inflammatory response unless there are a lot of antioxidants around. And that's where the vegetables and the fruit come in to being so important, because they're full of enzymes and antioxidants that help to mitigate these negative reactions. So these reactions are supposed to be in balance in our body. And when we're eating natural foods, they can be. But when we're eating synthetic foods, as you describe it, they're not. And then, you know, it's interesting. You talk about the gliadomorphins, and we're wondering why our kids are behaving oddly in schools when we, you know, give them lots of this highly processed, very highly saturated in gluten, because our wheat now has approximately 22% gluten, where in the past it didn't. And gluten is totally undigestible by humans. We don't have the enzymes to digest this at all. So when there used to be a tiny amount of it in the wheat, we could tolerate that. But even if you look at when did our ancestors see wheat? They saw it when there were some wild grasses growing, and they would get it in season for a few weeks, and then it would be gone.
Yeah,
they weren't constantly bombarded with it many times a day. Now it's hard, so hard to avoid.
Well, what did they say? Oreo cookies were more addictive than crack or something like that recently in the news. I was chuckling, but then I was sort of mortified, you know, because that's kind of the one of the food groups of many, many people out there.
Exactly right, calling it a food group. You know, soda is not a food group.
Right.
There were the old days when the Reagan administration tried to have ketchup declared a vegetable because they wanted to serve French fries and ketchup for school lunches and call it two vegetables.
Right.
Good
old Ron.
Yeah.
Ay, ay, ay. Now, you can be malnourished and still be obese, right, and look really to someone that they're not malnourished. I think you actually give a case of a lawyer in your book.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. We have an abundance of calories in this country, but we have a lack of nutrition. We, you know, the majority of our population does not meet the targets for the basic targets for the recommended daily allowance, which are really basic. You know, the recommended daily allowance is very, for most nutrients, is just barely getting to the level of being adequate for the kind of lifestyle that we live in North America, where there's much more stress, both physiological stress and psychological stress, that requires our enzyme systems, our processes in our body, to utilize a lot of these nutrients just to detoxify all the garbage that we're taking in terms of chemicals. You know, from 50 years between 1950 and 2000, there were 75,000 new chemicals put on the market.
Wow.
And most of them had no safety data on them whatsoever, and companies are just allowed to use them. Well, that has an impact on us, to be exposed to that many substances which our body has to detoxify, for which we don't even have detoxification methods. And so it messes up the mechanisms, things like the mitochondria, which are the little energy cells in our muscle tissues. Well, they're in all tissues, but our muscles have a particularly high concentration of mitochondria because they need so much energy. Mitochondria are very vulnerable to damage from free radicals. And if they're not replenished by antioxidants frequently, they stop functioning. And you can see this in people with chronic muscle diseases like fibromyalgia, which I think has a strong toxicity component. That hasn't been proven yet, other than in individual practices, those of us who look for toxicities. But even that, you know, because it's a difficult thing to do. There aren't the levels of studies that both you and I would like to see on looking for toxicity.
I mean, we see it a lot, as you know. We a lot of the functional medicine testing that's kind of done where we can actually look at some of the mitochondrial organic acids, which are, you know, given off by the body. It's kind of like the analogy of, when you go to motor vehicles and they put the thing up the tailpipe and they can see from the exhaust how well the engine's running from patient's exhaust, their urine and stool and hair and even the breath sometimes. With the breath hydrogen test, you can see how well they're functioning with some of the functional medicine tests. But you know what? I'm looking at the time. We have to take a break, and I think we may be playing our little module that Dr. Kamai and myself do, the natural medicine chest. But when we return, Dr. Tick, I want to talk about a little bit more about ways to deal with pain besides diet and lifestyle, and talk about the rest of your book here, because you certainly spend a lot of time talking about antioxidants and your digestion and also mind-body techniques and detoxification. So stay with us as we continue to talk about holistic pain relief, Dr. Tick's breakthrough strategies to manage and eliminate pain. Stay with us right here on PRN.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll explore the medicinal properties of the plants of the ephedra genera, focusing on the traditional Chinese ephedra, also known as mahuang.
Many species of the plant ephedra are used today in medicine throughout the world. The most medicinal of these are Ephedra sinica, or Chinese mahuang, and Ephedra nevadensis, also known as Mormon tea. Most of the research on ephedra has been performed on mahuang, whose stems and branches have been used as a traditional Chinese medicine for over 5,000 years in the treatment of asthma, hay fever, bronchitis, as well as the common cold.
Ephedra species are erect evergreen shrubs which grow in segmented bamboo-like joints reminiscent of straw ending in thin wisps. They typically are desert plants preferring arid conditions on dry, rocky, and sandy slopes. The Chinese ephedra, mahuang, has earned an impressive reputation as a source of the alkaloid chemical called ephedrine. In the West, scientists became interested in the medicinal usage of mahuang after they isolated ephedrine and pseudoephedrine in 1923. Today, synthetic derivatives have become widely used in prescription and over-the-counter medications. In 1993, over 40 million prescriptions in the U.S. contained these alkaloids.
Ephedra and its relatives are considered to act pharmacologically as sympathomimetic compounds. This means that they stimulate the sympathetic part of our central nervous system, responsible for the release of adrenaline, which leads to the fight or flight response. Ephedra also affects the cardiovascular system by increasing the blood pressure and causes a relaxation and dilation of the bronchial smooth muscles in asthmatics. Ephedra can shrink the swelling of the delicate mucous membranes which line the respiratory system, thus drying up watery discharges, unstuffing clogged nasal and sinus passages which accompany colds, sinus conditions, and allergies.
In both animal and human studies, mahuang has been shown to accelerate weight loss. It has been shown not only to suppress appetite, but to increase the metabolic activity of the adipose or fat tissue. Therefore, ephedra's weight-reducing effects are most significant in individuals who have a low metabolic rate or a sluggish thyroid gland.
Mahuang is a powerful herb which, when abused, can cause some unwanted side effects. Ephedra should not be taken by those with high blood pressure, nervousness or anxiety, insomnia, cardiac conditions, or pregnancy. Studies indicate that when used in conjunction with other Chinese herbs in a traditional formula, mahuang does not have any of these effects and has remarkable beneficial effects on human health.
We recommend consulting a healthcare practitioner knowledgeable in the use of botanical medicine before using mahuang, so you can be further educated about its totality of effects. And before using herbal preparations with mahuang, check to see if you are sensitive to its effects by starting with the minimal dose and working up to a therapeutic dose. Logically, since ephedra is a stimulant itself, it should be used prudently with other stimulants, beverages, or drugs with stimulant effects. Again, consult with your natural healthcare practitioner.
So, listeners, remember mahuang, the traditional Chinese ephedra, and make sure to include it in your natural medicine chest.
And I guess we're back with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. So we're excited again to have Dr. Heather Tick on, and she is from the University of Washington, and she's the first Gunlock Endowed Professor for Integrative Pain Management. We're talking about pain in her book, Holistic Pain Relief. So, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, I had a question, and, you know, it has to do with the neurochemistry of pain. When did some of these drugs that are traditionally used for depression and things like that make their way into managing pain? I'll give you an example, like neurologic pain or peripheral neuropathy and using GABAergic drugs or, you know, serotonin-based medicine for pain. We see a lot of that, like we see it in some of the drug commercials, like, you know, depression causes pain, and so you need to take antidepressants when you're in pain. So Can you comment on that, Dr. Tick?
Sure. I think that I think that drug companies are really good at marketing themselves, and sometimes they've even been known to create these neat little acronyms for disorders that make them seem like more of a thing than is actually necessary or useful. So one of those, for example, is a gastroesophageal reflux disorder, GERD. That used to be heartburn. When it was heartburn, we knew, oh, I ate something wrong. I better not eat that again,
right,
or don't do it too often. When you call it GERD, well, suddenly you've got a lot of people wanting to prescribe something, and you're hearing about it. And I think the same thing has happened with depression. So we have many studies showing that antidepressants in mild and moderate and early severe depression are just as good as placebos.
Ah.
With far fewer side effects to the placebos. But, again, when you're doing research, you get answers to the questions you ask. And if you're really careful about asking your questions, you can get things to look quite good when what they're checking is really irrelevant.
Mm.
But it looks good, and it makes a nice sound bite.
You know, in one way, let me just interject. In one way, you know, I'll give you an example. When I got out of school out in Bastyr, I took a postgraduate course in amino acid therapy. And some of the older literature talks about that if you can raise people's endorphins and enkephalins through natural means, i.e. special amino acids, special qigong breathing techniques, other types of ways, even, you know, good chocolate that's healthy for you. And if you can raise the endorphins and enkephalins, you'll modulate pain in people that have been non-responsive. I remember there was a study. They had a group with OA pain, osteoarthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, fibrositis, polymyositis, whiplash pain. Nothing helped these people, but when they put them on different amino acids, helped tremendously. So, I don't know.
But you see, amino acids are things that are naturally occurring that your body knows what to do with and your
right.
brain knows what to do with. When we're talking about drugs, we're talking more about a sledgehammer than something that does fine-tuning. And when you're doing exercise, for example, you also raise endorphins. It's a wonderful way of decreasing pain naturally and improving mood all at the same time. So it's not to say that there aren't uses for drugs. I mean, drugs are developed for very particular reasons, and when in the old days they used to really be looking to create drugs to solve problems and to help with diseases. These days they're more and more trying to figure out how to get a healthy population to take drugs, because there's more of the healthy population. And so if you can convince everybody that a cholesterol above a certain level is actually a disease state, you can get what do we have right now? A quarter of the entire U.S. population over 40 is on a statin.
Yeah.
You know, were we all born with statin deficiency?
Right. I'd like to have stock in those.
yeah.
No, and then
the problem is that statins are actually, why do I talk so much about them in the book? Because they're an issue with pain.
Right.
Because when you are taking statins, you're also inhibiting coenzyme Q10 formation in all your cells. Well, all of your muscles and your nerve cells need coenzyme Q10. And so statins are actually become another cause of heart disease, because the heart is a huge consumer of CoQ10. And if your cells can't make it, you have a problem.
So the very thing that the very edifice that they're building this paradigm on is crumbling, because they're trying to save the heart with statins, but at the same time they're causing cardiomyopathies, you're saying.
they're causing, I'm not sure of the exact pathology of it, but they could be increasing the risk of heart failure and malfunction of the muscle. So, technically speaking,
I mean, the first thing I think of if someone has problems with their heart is certainly CoQ10 because it's a muscle.
Yes. And the first thing I'm sure you think of when somebody comes in with heart disease isn't I have to check their cholesterol number and treat the number. I have to look at this person holistically and get them on a heart-healthy lifestyle, which is mind, body, spirit. It's everything. And it's the same with pain. So pain is affected by mind, body, and spirit. So we've already spoken about all the different things that can raise endorphins, which are our natural painkillers. Breathing exercises can increase those neurotransmitters. And Candace Pert, who recently died, the brilliant neurophysiologist, she said that there is through breathing exercises, we can access every single sort of neuropeptide that there is. All of those neurotransmitters are accessible to us through breathing exercises. And if you look at a lot of traditional cultures, they used to reach very euphoric states, not always drug-induced, sometimes breathing-induced.
I mean, it's the basis of whole types of yoga, the whole pranayamic and also Qigong in China, which is actually, if you go to a Chinese hospital, it's actually a whole wing of the hospital is Qigong practitioners that's just as revered as allopathic interventions there.
Mm-hmm.
So breathing is very important, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think the best, I mean, my main message is that the best combination, the best way in order to help our patients is for all of these disciplines. For your profession, my profession, for the Qigong, the massage therapists, the osteopaths, the chiropractors, for everybody to be working together. And we haven't even mentioned the energy medicine, so we haven't named them that way, but the practices of Qigong, of yoga, of the martial arts that you're fond of, those are all partly energy medicine. But then again, everything's energy.
Right. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about why pain tends to kind of manifest from different emotional disorders. Is it always this whole adrenal sympathetic type of thing, or are there other deeper issues? I mean, we look at the body like a hologram, and I know people hold trauma in there, and some of my most greatest patient breakthroughs is when a patient told me a deep, dark secret. You know, I'm feeling beklempt actually thinking about some of my patients, and it was on their soul for so long. They haven't told anyone, and they found the sacred space to talk about it, and their pain vanished. I mean, how do we explain those types of humor?
I don't know that we necessarily have explanations for everything. I mean, we search for them, but as scientists, we sometimes have the hubris to think that it's only those things that we can explain that actually are real. And in fact, the sun warmed the earth long before we knew the scientific explanation. And we accepted it. And the same thing with a lot of the miraculous things that you describe. I mean, there are people who do hold very early traumas, and they cause pain. And I don't think we understand all of the ways in which they do, other than we're all energy, and energy can be disturbed and interrupted. And we're starting to get a little bit of more of a physiological understanding of that, but I don't know that we'll ever get there totally. I mean, sometimes I feel as though we've taken a little bit of ocean water out of Puget Sound, and we've analyzed it to death, and we know every single molecule that's in it. And on that basis, we want to predict the actions of the entire oceans and the entire world over time.
Nice.
You know, it's too complicated. Are we ever going to be able to do that? I don't personally think so. I think some things will remain mysterious.
I remember I had a patient with mysterious GI pain, and I'm sure you see this a lot in teenage girls, for instance. This is like I've seen hordes of them coming through my office in the last couple of years, and having unexplained GI pain and, you know, going through batteries and batteries of tests from the gastroenterologist and not really seeing things out of order. Maybe we, you know, the flora was a little bit off, but not enough to explain the tremendous pain that they're going through, you know, negative for all the structural things, no endometriosis, none of these things like that. Hormones seem to be okay, yet lots and lots of pain. And it had to do with the stress of being a teenager. People hold stress in different areas, like a hologram, and I'm sure that leads to chronic pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think we're starting to get, we've got three major areas of research right now that I find very exciting that all have to do with pain. One is neuroplasticity, of course, the way in which the brain can change itself and nerve pathways can miraculously do things. You know, what we focus on is what gets reinforced with our nerve cells and things that fire together, wire together. So when you do things habitually, when you focus on an area that might be painful, that was part of a trauma, if you keep focusing on it, that actually becomes hardwired into our system. But we can change it, too. In the same way that it got changed into that, we can change it out of that if we recognize what it is. So neuroplasticity. The other area that's fascinating is fascia. There's so much amazing research happening on that. We used to think fascia was junk. We used to think it was no more alive than scaffolding on the outside of a building.
Mm.
And in fact, it's a living tissue that's an energy transduction system. And there are some people who are saying that that the meridians may actually be pathways, energy pathways through the fascia. So when we were cutting into the body looking for channels and tubes that would represent the meridians, we were cutting through what was important, because when you dissect fascia, you have to do blunt dissection or you don't actually, you cut through it, you ruin it. And then the third area is what you had mentioned with gut flora, the microbiome.
Mm.
We've just begun to recognize how important the microbiome is. And fortunately, the NIH, National Institutes of Health, have created a consortium just to study the microbiome because they recognize it as being so important.
Like the old naturopathic saying that Dr. Bastier himself used to say, when in doubt, treat the gut. This is what
Yes.
he would always say. When you have a hard case and you don't know where to go, focus on the gut. And I thought that was like such a powerful aphorism.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it is so out of step with allopathic medicine for the most part. Even with gut disorders, when you have inflammatory bowel disease or certainly with irritable bowel disease, I can't tell you how many times I have heard physicians say it has nothing to do with what you eat. I mean, I'm astounded.
Yeah.
The other area where they do that is with skin problems, that, you know, skin has nothing to do with what you eat. Well,
right.
Skin has everything to do with what you eat. It's the major detox organ of the body. And if you're taking in too many toxins or the wrong kinds of foods for your system, and you can't detoxify in other ways, it comes through the skin.
Yeah, and the detoxification, you have a nice chapter on detoxification and kind of supporting those pathways, because sometimes when people are very toxic, which, you know, it's funny, I stopped advertising myself as doing detoxification because I just get calls of people that are on opioids and want a way off them.
Oh.
They're not really, so we need to come up with a new word, like the old timers use depuration, which people don't even know what it means, I
yeah.
guess, which means like deep, deep cleansing, and how that was so important for pain management in the old days. And now we're actually, I just went to a conference in San Diego, and Dr. Pizzorno, who's, you know,
mm-hmm.
used to be associated with Bastier, he
yeah.
did a scientific explanation of how changing patients' pH really does help with pain. And other illnesses where it was considered, you know, kind of like more of a folkloric thing, like, okay, we eat the diet, we change your pH, and people feel better. But there, he dug through the scientific literature and found some interesting stuff. So I guess the old saying is if natural medicine works, there has to be some explanation, not that it's totally necessary to always know why things work, but, you know, we kind of live in a scientific, at some level, doctors are scientists, too, but we're also healers, like you mentioned at the beginning.
Yeah, well, it's both. And we want to strive for looking for answers, absolutely. That issue in pH is really interesting, and getting people to do a first morning urine pee onto a pH paper can be really instructive, because they can see how what they eat changes their pH, and they can plot how they feel that day.
Yeah,
I'm very much in agreement with that. That's a great idea.
Yeah, and I guess to put it all together as we wind down, let's a person's in a lot of pain now. They're listening. They want to start somewhere. Can you give them some really good tips, a to-do list on certain things that they can do right now?
Sure. First thing is eat more vegetables. Wherever you're starting with your diet, increase the numbers of vegetables that you're eating. You know, if you're timid about vegetables, start with, you know, one a day. And it can be a different vegetable every day, or it can be the same one every day. Doesn't matter. Just get them into you. Doesn't matter if they are cooked or raw. Don't use canned for the most part, unless they're home canned and you know that they've got some nutrition left in them. But frozen are just fine. Make sure that you sleep. We need between 7 and 8 hours of sleep per night, and it has been shown over and over again that if you sleep deprive healthy young university students, they will get pain. So sleep is a crucial key towards body repair, and we don't even know all of the ways in which sleep works, but we do know some of the repair mechanisms that happen overnight that prepare us for the next day. Thirdly, do something to look after your stress. And it might be mindfully walking, paying attention while you do a moving meditation like walking or yoga or Tai Chi or a martial art. It might be just breathing, mindfully taking 10 minutes and just paying attention to your breath. And
just at traffic lights. For those commuting that say they have no time. So I tell patients, okay, you have no time. Do you have time at a traffic light? Oh, sure. Okay.
Yeah.
Every time you're at a traffic light, that's your mindfulness breathing thing. So, you know, a lot of people
Great
have
idea.
Excuses, but keep going on your list, dude.
Yeah. And then the other meditative time is take, you know, most of us inhale our food and we're eating quickly and we don't even recognize and enjoy what's on our plate. But choose one thing that's on your plate at one meal a day and just really eat it mindfully, slowly, look at it, sniff it, taste it, feel what it feels like in your mouth, chew slowly, mindfully, many times, twice as long as you would ordinarily chew a piece of food, and then feel what it feels like when you swallow it down, and spend those few minutes while you're eating anyway just to mindfully do that. And I think build a team of people who support you, and those can be your friends, those can be your family, those can be your healthcare professionals. For people who are in chronic pain, very often joining group activities like a yoga class, a Tai Chi class, a mindfulness-based meditation class, an education class on, there are pain education classes that happen in a lot of communities. Those things, because pain is often very isolating, doing things in groups, that group energy is important for people. It helps them to feel supported. And sometimes those kinds of connections are profound, even if they don't become, you know, bosom buddy kinds of soul-bearing experiences. Somehow that energy of people being in the same place, doing the same thing, having a similar intention of doing good for themselves and being kind to each other, it makes makes a profound difference for people.
Yeah. As long as it does. It's funny, one of my first patients who had chronic pain, he had to leave some of his old kind of arthritis fibromyalgia groups, which had become piss and moan sessions, so to speak. And he joined a more progressive vegetarian cooking thing that then led him to meet communities in yoga and qigong and mindfulness. And to him, that was like shedding stuff that was holding him back. So that was kind of interesting. I remember I wrote about that in our arthritis book that myself and Dr. Kamai wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Really excited. I'm really glad that you were on the program today. I'm jealous of my colleagues out in Bastyr that I'd love to have you here on the East Coast. Tell us a little bit about your book, where people can get it, and your practice, and your website.
Okay. Website is www.heathertickmd.com, and I've got some health information on there. The book is called Holistic Pain Relief, and it is available through Barnes & Noble, both in the stores and the website. It's on Amazon. It's on the website for the publisher, which is New World Library. I don't know if you have Canadian listeners, but up there it's going to be sold at the grocery store chain called Loblaws and the drugstore chain called Shoppers Drug Mart. And it was written to be a resource for people, to help people navigate the maze that they find in their lives, and also to help them find good quality professionals who are naturopaths and chiropractors. I don't have specific names in the book, but just in terms of some idea of how do you build a team that helps you through this, because you do need a team. It isn't just one physician or one, whether it's a naturopath or an MD. And my practice is at the Center for Pain Relief, which is an anesthesia-based pain clinic at the University of Washington. It's the original pain clinic in the world, started by Dr. John Benica many years ago. And it's a very progressive place, as you can tell, because they've really embraced the idea that we have to get people off of unnecessary drugs and opioids, and we have to provide more than just high-risk interventions. We have to provide integrative care.
Thank you so much, and good luck with the book and helping so many people out there.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Okay. Dr. Heather Tick, author of Holistic Pain Relief, Her Breakthrough Strategies to Manage and Eliminate Pain. Definitely on the keeper list here. And thanks for joining us on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on PRN. Take care and be well. Bye-bye.